Okay, so what's the, we actually changed, sorry for the L3 actually is an error, it's L4 of course. We are starting the fourth chapter of our discussion, and we're dealing with transcriptomes. And so what we're going to do in this week is to examine first the main character, the main features of the transcriptome in vertebrates, what actually is coming up from the ENCODE and Phantom projects and similar. And then starting from tomorrow and next on Thursday, we will discuss, not tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday, we will discuss alternative splicing regulation and then the microRNA story. Okay, so that's kind of story like this. Finally, you will have we will have lesson Monday, and then we also have a lesson on next Wednesday. That is the last one. I won't be there. There will be my PhD. Let's say she's finishing, so she's no longer a PhD student, but anyway, something like. And she will talk to you about circular RNA. That is kind of a new story. Okay, so that's the plan. And, another communication is that on Wednesday, I don't remember if Wednesday or Thursday, probably Thursday, we have to switch lesson with bioinformatics. But I think that most of you follow the two lessons. So you will have first bioinformatics and then... This is not working. Okay, so the we start with the story, and what we define transcriptomics is another omic, of course, genomics and transcriptomics. Okay, the key aims of transcriptomics are to catalog all species of transcript, including messenger RNA, of course, non-coding RNAs and small RNAs. Second, to determine the transcriptional structure of genes in terms of their start site, 5' and 3' ends, splicing patterns, and other post-transcriptional modifications. And three, to quantify the changing expression level of each transcript during development and under different experimental or pathological conditions. So actually, everything concerning what results from the transcription, okay? So of course, this is a strong application in medicine and pharmaceutics because, of course, in medicine, people are using a lot this kind of gene expression profiles to characterize a disease, like making diagnosis and prognosis and whatever. If we have time, we will see some example of them, but this is a kind of pathology subject, so it's probably you expect more from pathology or genetics, or medical genetics. Anyway, we will see. And of course, very important for pharmaceutical industry because it's very important to evaluate the effect, the cryptic effect of a drug. Because for evaluating in vivo on cells, you have to have a phenotype. And not always you have an evident phenotype for a drug, but you can see by making gene expression profile, you can see even subtle effects on gene expression that may result in a, in a later time to different kind of results. Okay? So... I have only three slides in gray because this is something that you should know from your basic molecular biology, just to remember to you that if you don't have this kind of knowledge, please go back to revise it, that accessing to RNA, we have fundamentally two kinds of approaches. One is hybridization, so probes, RNA, and CD hybridization or measuring or whatever, okay? And second, we have the sequencing. So we can make trick and tracks to make sequencing of RNA or complementary DNA anyway. to assess by sequencing. Okay, this is the two common methods. And as you probably remember, when you are in let's say in pregenomic or in the classical molecular biology books, you see this kind of methods to measure expression of single or few genes that are Northern blotting. And you probably remember the methods. Do you? Yeah. And this RT-PCR and QRT-PCR, probably you remember. Maybe you don't remember this RNase protection assay, that this is now hybridization method in liquid. Anyway, no problem. So these are the methods were used once upon a time, but also today, actually. As a matter of fact, especially this QRT-PCR is very popular in the labs, so that's the story, okay? And also for accessing by sequencing, of course, you have to make the classical path, the classical cell, extract, purify, reverse transcribe, cloning plasmid or phage vector, and then have a library of cDNA and then Sanger sequencing. That is this approach that was used several years ago. And the main problem with this kind of story was that usually cDNAs that you can get out of this approach are not complete, especially because the RT enzyme is not processed. Okay, so you never go to the 5 prime. And also because actually you have short sequencing. I mean, you can also sequence them most of the time short tags, so you don't have a description of the entire RNA. So, okay, that's it. So close the parenthesis and go to the story. So the story now is this one. Transcriptomics actually was born with microarrays. Okay, so something like in 1995, this guy here, that was Pat Brown, developed this kind of microarrays in his laboratory, making spotted cDNA microarrays. So in other words, he had a collection of cDNA representing different genes, okay, cloned cDNA, okay, coming from the approaches before, and he spotted in the glass, okay, like with micropipettes or some other device like this, making very small drops of it, okay, and then drying these stories, and so they were probes available for hybridization of RNA. Okay, and this is the, I know that bioinformatics has explained it to you very well what the microarrays are, so we just make the story short. Okay, so this is the, of course, is a hybridization with fluorescently labeled cDNA. Okay, so this is the method. In 2000, of course, this is limited to the known genes. This, of course, even though if you take all the genes that you know coming from the sequencing Human Genome Project or whatever, still you have what you know you can spot, what you don't know you cannot spot. So no discovery from this kind of approach. And very soon people realized that this actually transcriptions was probably going beyond what was known already as a description. And so in as you can see in 2002, Affymetrix developed this kind of tiling arrays. We talked already about this. So all the probes covering all the genome and try to make this kind of profiling with the story. This actually very, very short-lived, I mean, few years, because as soon as in 2005, 2006, appeared the next generation sequences. So this was abandoned, especially because, as I told you, it required an enormous number of microarrays to cover all the genome. So it was very expensive. Very expensive, very cumbersome. So anyway. So now, starting from 2005, 2006, people started to make mRNA-seq, and this with NGS, of course. And in 2008, actually, we had the first paper that you will see in a moment describing RNA expression in several cell lines. Okay. So, okay, this is the comment that I told you before, and actually there was also another kind of, method developed to make unbiased analysis of the transcriptome that was using EST or SAGE. Probably we talked already about SAGE's like CAGE, making small tags and making concatamers and then sequencing by Sanger. It's always a difficult story, but anyway, people use that. So in the repositories, like the Gene Expression Omnibus or whatever, you find some experiments still run by this kind of methods. Of course, the major limitation for this kind of approach is that you describe only very small parts of any transcript. So, no, you don't have any idea how the transcript is made. Okay, so I try to give you some reviews as textbook for this last chapter. And actually, from the point of view that real, say, transcriptome overall, there is no virtual review describing it. So I choose one of these reviews that is talking on non-coding RNAs, but actually inside you can find almost all the discussion about also the protein coding genes, so it's probably enough for you. Okay, it's written quite good, and this John Matix is one of the experts of this story, so it's okay. It's sufficiently recent, so actually the numbers that you see inside, the number of RNA and so, is quite adjourned. Okay. So one of the first things that he says in this review is the proliferation and evolution of RNA sequencing technologies, so many different methods evolving, and this is really true in the sense that each year we see novel things appearing on the market, okay, including the advent of methods like targeted RNA sequencing, we will discuss in a minute, or single molecule RNA sequencing and single cell sequencing continues to enlarge our understanding of transcriptional diversity. And actually this enlarges a real world in the sense that we assisted to enormous increase of the number of transcripts in these years. Okay. Okay, so RNA-seq, as you know, is another communication. I talked with a professor of bioinformatics. I know that Professor Becuti today will complete stories about the algorithm. But starting from tomorrow, Professor Cordero will start again with RNA-seq. So I make the story extremely short because you will have description very carefully from Professor Cordero. Okay, so just to make the story understandable. Okay, so the RNA-seq again is the total RNA extraction. Then usually we get rid of ribosomal. This is an important difference from other methods. When you make microarrays, you don't care about ribosomal RNA because it's a lot. Okay, it makes something like 95% of RNA in the cell. Okay, so when you make microarrays or whatever else, you don't care about it. It's not a problem for hybridization methods. But here you are sequencing. So if you keep the RNA, the ribosomal RNA in your preparation, you are going to make 95% of your sequencing reads will be attributed to a ribosomal RNA. It's completely useless. You spend a lot of money for nothing. Okay, so you usually get rid of ribosomal RNA. There are kits in the market that actually are very efficient in removing ribosomal RNA. Okay, so we call this fraction ribominus. You will find this name several times. So called ribo minus RNA means that you get rid of this ribosomal RNA fraction. And then you can make further selection if you want, like for example making poly A plus selections with oligo-DT columns, or there are other kind of selection that are more sophisticated, like taking only repetitive RNA or targeted RNA when you select some particular message. Okay. Then when you have go through this further selection, you go to the reverse transcriptase, and so you make cDNA. Okay. Then you have the library preparation. You can have fragmentation depending on the protocols and on the different flavors of this technology. You can make fragmentation at the level of RNA here, okay, or at the level of cDNA. More or less it's the same, okay, so you can make fragmentation in the two kinds, okay. Then you have these fragments, so you make library preparation, and again you have several choices, because you are not at the level of genomic DNA, which you have only one thing to do. Okay, here you can concentrate on small RNA. Usually we say small RNA less than 200 bases, nucleotides. Okay, and this is for technical problem. Whenever you have less than 200, you have to make a particular library. Okay, otherwise when you have longer RNA, you make another kind of library. So it's really a real technical problem. Okay, and then you can choose if making a double-stranded, so in the two senses, okay, a library. Okay, when you make a random priming, you know what is a random priming, no? We discussed it already. You put just like hexamer or octamers that are completely random as a sequence. They go to attach, okay, any kind of RNA, all right? And then you put reverse transcriptase. Can you follow me? Okay, so you make single-stranded cDNA. At this point, you denature RNA, okay, and you prime it again with the same hexamer or octamer mix, so they prime other different stories on the single-stranded cDNA, and then you extend them. At this point, you have cDNA, and you don't know, you have no sign of which was the sense and which is the antisense. Okay, so in the very first application, for example, all the RNA-seq was unstranded. So you don't know, you read a sequence, but you don't know if it was in the sense DNA or in the other antisense. Okay, so now we go to most of the sequences today are made with single strand. There is a trick you will see in a minute to orient the reverse transcription in order to know which is the strand. And then you go to sequencing, okay, so once you have made the library, you go to sequencing, and sequencing, again, you have many choices to go through. The first is if you make a single end or paired end. Have you studied in bioinformatics what it means? More or less, yeah. In the Illumina machine, you remember this kind of primers attached to the glass, okay? They are complementary to the adapters, then you sequence from the other side. Okay. So you can repeat the procedure. So you can wash away everything after the first cycle of sequencing, wash away everything, and repeat the procedure using the other side of the story. The repeating sequencing. In this case, you have the two small sequences from the same fragment. So these are called paired ends because you have end tags from the same fragment, okay? When you sequence a DNA, usually you don't need to have paired end tags because usually it's sufficient to have single end and having sufficiently long reads to map on the genome, okay? But when you're looking for RNA, that are spliced, so you have many, many problems we will see in a minute. It's much better to have paired tags. So we know that the two sequences are close to each other, so they can resolve problem of splicing and other problems of mapping. Then you have to choose the length, because as probably you know, whenever you make a sequencing, for example, by Illumina, you can choose if making 50 nucleotides, 75, they sell usually packs of 25 nucleotides at a time, so you can make 50, 75, 100 and whatever. Okay, and this length depends on the kind of application you make and also how much money you have. Because this is the most costly story. The main cost with the Illumina sequencing is the fluorescent nucleotides. They cost a lot of money. So if you extend a lot, means making much more cycles and so much more money. Okay, so you have to balance a little bit what you know. Okay. And then the depth, you know what is the depth. The depth is how many fragments you sequence per sample. Okay, so that's important also. Okay, so a typical RNA-seq experiment is this one. So you start from messenger RNA or total RNA. You remove, of course, contaminant DNA with the DNAs, and then you fragment RNA, reverse transcribe into cDNA, or vice versa. I told you, you can fragment the cDNA. And then you make ligation of the two adapters, select a range of size. Usually, this is a critical part in the procedure. And then you sequence the ends, okay, single or pair, depending on the choice you make. Okay, so I put just yes on strain-specific RNA-seq because today this is the only choice. For example, Illumina doesn't sell anymore the kit to make unstranded RNA-seq. So this is out of the commerce. Okay? And then when you have pirated, then you have to go through data analysis. That means that you have to eliminate some of the bad reading, okay? And remove artifacts like, for example, a sequence that is sequenced two times or more times. And then at this point, you can either go directly to alignment, so to align to a library of a reference library of transcripts and quantify the expression, or to assemble new transcripts by making overlapping fragments to each other. Okay, you will learn about it by informatics. Okay. Anyway, when you align the read to transcript libraries, you can quantify the expression because you can count how many reads go to each gene or each transcript. Okay, so this is the story. So mapping, of course, I just bring your attention to one problem. Mapping is not easy because, of course, you will have both short reads in exons, like this, okay? And you can have reads that are junction reads, so they are part in one exon and part in the other one. But, of course, the number of these junction reads is very low as compared to the exonic reads. Okay, and this your possibility to describe, for example, exon skipping, like in this case, you have a read here and a read here, that will say that you have a transcript without exons in between. Okay, but this depends strongly on the depth that you make in the sequences, because if you find only one read of this thing, is insignificant, so you cannot use it. Okay, so the quantitative point of view from the RNA-seq is to count how many reads go to a region or a transcription unit, or whatever is your reference, okay? And you express in RPKM, that is the reads per kilobase per million reads. Okay, you make a double normalization, both for sequencing depth and for gene length. So you divide the read counts by the per million scanning factor. That means that if you make different depth sequencing, you have to normalize for the depth of the other reads. So it's million scanning factor, okay? And then you divide the RPM values that you have obtained by the length of the genes, of course. If a gene is very long, it will take much more reads than a short gap. Okay, so you express by this. You always find the expression by this. Okay, you there is another expression, this FPKM, that is very similar, and fragments per kilobase per millions, and this has been developed when you make paradigm sequencing, because of course you consider the pairing ends as belonging to the same fragment, and so this is counted as a fragment per kilobase per million. Okay, quantitative, just a caution on the story of quantitative, because again we have older experiments that are in database and newer experiments that are in database, and they differ a little bit on the kind of bioinformatic algorithm that has been used. For example, many older experiments, they do not account for the changing in the density of the reads in the different exons. They just count the reads over the length of the gene, okay, like this. Okay, you count this read plus this one plus this one. Okay, they don't care if an exon is completely underrepresented, and they say, okay, this gene is expressed. That is good, the gene is expressed, but you cannot discriminate the isoforms, of course, in this case. Newer algorithms actually distinguish this kind of situation, and usually they say, okay, this transcript is expressed, the other one with the exon included is not, and blah, blah. Okay, so it's just a caution when you consider kind of different experiments. Okay, one of the major variables in RNA-seq experiments is the sequencing depth. This is extremely important because many, as you will see in a minute, many of the newly discovered RNA transcripts, they are very low. They show very low expression. Okay, so of course there is a ratio that you have to consider whenever you sequence an RNA, that the depth is really important. Always remember that the molecules you have sequenced that are only a sample of the total possible reads. Okay, so this is really important. This is just one example. In this is an experiment in which this is the number of ORF, in the sense that protein coding, okay, detected if you increase the number of uniquely mapped tags, reads the same story. Okay, so you see that you can detect more and more ORFs as the number of reads increase, and then you go to a plateau, of course, because number of protein coding genes is limiting, so at this point you go. And this is the same story looking for star sites. If you try to map the transcription star site, the same. So the number of mapped tags in million, and you have this kind of... So whenever you have a sequencing experiment, considering the number of reads is extremely important, because it will tell you which proportion of the true transcript is actually detected in the experiment. Okay, from the qualitative point of view, on the other side, normally the reads are aligned to the reference genome, or more often to the a limited reference. For example, the RefSeq, that is a collection of all the transcripts, okay, or the gene code transcript, you will see in a minute, and so on. Or you can reduce, for example, in many experiments, you just limit to the exome. The exome is only the collection of all the known exons. If you are interested only in protein coding, there is no way, no reason to go to different reference database. You can limit. Okay, this usually limiting the database is also limiting your knowledge, but it's much easier. Of course, and the statistical power you can get is increasingly higher. Okay. Then sometimes you have to take in account the splicing reads. Many algorithms do not take in account the splicing reads. just take care of the exotic breeds, okay? Just because they are much more difficult to take to take in account. So this can be a choice that the people will do depending on the kind of problem they study, okay? And then finally the sense and anti-sense. You will see in a minute this story. Okay, the common problems that I told you is the depth, of course, but also the length of the reeds, of course. Going back to the story, okay, look at the problem of splicing like this, okay? To define a splicing event, you need a reed that maps partly in one direction, partly in the other one. But that, as you remember, this kind of fragmentation is completely random, okay? So to imagine to have a reed of 50 bases, for example, okay? In order to be sure that you correctly map this reed here and the other one here, you need at least 20 base pair on both sides. Otherwise, as you know, less than 20 you probably don't map a unique place in the genome, okay? So this means that the reads that are selected as a true splicing events are very few, really very few. Because if you have, for example, a read like this one that takes, say, 40 here and 10 on the other side, it's just discarded, okay? So this is a real problem when you consider the splicing reads. And finally, given the strengths, as I told you before, because we know today that many genes can be overlapping in the sense that you have a transcript in one sense and another transcript in the other sense. So you cannot decide. If you have no stranded sequence, you cannot decide which is what the one. Okay? So there are solutions to this. The first one is to make longer reads, as longer as better, of course, for mapping. Okay. And the second story is to make paired end. Paired end is this one, we discussed it already. This is just the scheme of step one and step two, as I told you. And third, to make this kind of strand-specific library. It's not difficult to make. It's just imagine this represents your RNAs, okay? So you make a random priming. This is the random priming, but each random oligonucleotide is attached to a defined adapter. That is the red part here, okay? So in this case, you prime wherever, and then making RT, you extend it, okay? So this is the newly extended cDNA, single strand. Then you get rid of the RNA, the green one, okay? And then you prime again with another random primer attached to a second adapter that is different from the first one. Okay? So you extend the cDNA, and at this point you are sure, looking at the sequence of the adapters, you are sure which is the strand that you are sequencing. Okay? So it's very easy, actually. One actually asked why they didn't think about this problem before, but anyway, this is the story. Okay, now let's see, after this discussion, so this is random, let's see what was the first paper. This in November 2008 was the first paper using RNA-seq. Okay, they used 15 diverse human tissues and cell line. And they made the very first story. They were short reads because at that time they still have something like 50 nucleotides per read. That was one of the first version of the story, okay? And so they had some difficulty in mapping, splicing, whatever, but they went to a very deep sequencing, okay? So they used something like 100 million reads per sample, and this is very depth. Very deep, and so they could actually study alternative isoforms. And so they reached the first evidence in sequence, because before that experiment, actually people knew something about using the tiling arrays, but was not that precise. Okay, actually, the first time they actually could realize that 92 to 94% of human genes actually undergo alternative splicing. And this was really a new, because before that date, we actually thought that the alternative splicing concerned a fraction of human genes, but very lower than this one. So they say essentially that almost all human genes undergo alternative splicing. So let's see what they did. So they just show you one example, saying these are two cDNA that were already in the data bank before their sequencing. Okay, so they were already in the NCBI data bank, described as cDNA, of course, as they did before. And as you can see, these two transcripts differ from one exon that is apparently mutually exclusive, in the sense that you have 3B or 3A, either one or the other one. And so this is a graph of these are the number of reads for each tissue, okay? And as you can see, this is the graph on the testes, liver, skeletal muscle, and heart. And as you can see, it's clearly described, this kind of splicing, because whenever you start from here, this line, the thickness of the lines means how many splicing reads were in between the two exons. Okay, so if you have a thin line, means few reads. Large line means many reads. Okay, so you see that this splicing is clearly described going to this 3B. Okay, there is no read going to the 3A exon. Okay. On the contrary, you can find some read from here to here. So what it means, this is a strange situation, right? Can you follow? Because either if you included the 3A, you should have some read going to here. No read going to there. So what you can conclude from this experiment? Try to think about it. Exactly. So you can. This is something that you really could not define with other approaches, like microarrays or whatever, because it tells you, okay, you have something starting here that is joined to this exon here, and means that you have a promoter over there somewhere. Okay. So this is a typical story about it. Okay. And the same for this. Also, in this case, you see. There is a transcript starting from here, no join, splicing reads in the left side, so it means that you have a promoter somewhere there. Okay. So many news, just to say, many novel situations from this kind of experiment. And if you see that this was actually the first experiment, was kind of very important story, because we realized that actually transcription is much more complex than what we thought before. Okay. So mapping all the stories, all the kind of alternative events that they saw in these 15 lines, they described something that is very important. Before examining these two slides, I want to ask you something. What do you know about alternative splicing? I include myself. What do we know about alternative splicing? Do you have a good idea about it? Quite? If you don't remember, can I just go through quickly to remember you something? Okay, alternative splicing was discovered in viruses more than 40 years ago. I was finishing my biology course that time, something like this. Okay. And in 1983, a vertebrate gene was discovered to make alternative splicing. And this is the famous gene that is almost in all molecular biology books, the gene that produces two different mRNAs encoding for calcitonin and CGRP. Calcitonin, if you know what it is the hormone that takes the level of calcium in the blood. And CGRP is a neuropeptide. Okay, so it was quite an important paper published on Nature in 1993. And this was described as an anecdotical story, because it was the first time, so people didn't know anything about alternative splicing. And so it took a while, actually, to have other publications showing that other gene transcripts also underwent so that's a sporadic way, really. I remember that period. And in that period, really, something like one paper every 2 or 3 years, so not really frequent to see, okay? Then, actually, the story started after 2000, more or less. In 2000, there was a famous paper in Cell describing a very striking thing. So it was the DSCAM gene in Drosophila insects. Okay, that was a kind of incredible gene. It has something like this. This is the organization of the DSCAM gene in Drosophila. You have an incredible number of exons. All the small lines that you, these are introns. All the small lines that you see there are exons. Okay, so it's a huge gene with an incredible number of exons. And especially, there are blocks of exons that are almost the same as a sequence. Something like having, imagine 150 bases that are repeated more with small changes, okay, like duplications and few mutations, several times. For example, exon 4, you have 12 different exons with small introns in between. Okay. Then you have, for exon 6, you have 48 blocks of this kind of sequence with small introns in between. Then 33 exon 9 with small introns in between, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. So this was a really astonishing paper, because when people started to make RT-PCR to see what was the result of this story, it turned out that all these exons are mutually exclusive. Mutually exclusive means that whenever one of the exon 4 is included in the transcript, included, all other versions of exon 4 are excluded. Okay? Exon 6, same. Whenever you have an exon 6 included, from here, for example, all the other exons are excluded whatsoever. So if you make a combinatorial story, it turns out that you can have 38,000 splicing variants out of this gene. So people started to make funny experiments after that, taking, you know, single-cell PCR. Do you know what it is? They take, yeah. They take, you know, the micro-injection capillaries. Okay, they took this kind of stories and picked up a little amount of cytosol from neurons. These are neuronal proteins. The DSCAM is the one that... Do you know what is the DSCAM in the insect? It's the one that avoids to make short circuits in the neurons. Neurons are many neurites and many axons. So they can get synapses. Of course, they should not make synapses with themselves. Okay. So DSCAM is a protein on the surface that actually, if you have the same DSCAM on two neurites, you cannot have contact. Okay. So this is the exclusion of the story. So they started to pick up a little amount of cytosol from different neurons and to make PCR to see what happened. Okay. And they discovered that actually each cell expressed only one of these possible 30,000 splicing variants. So it was a kind of an incredible story. Of course, when this paper was published, people started to look at DSCAM in humans, mouse, and whatever. It's not working the same. We have in the neurons, the vertebrates, we have a quite complex system of protocadherins taking care of the same phenomenon. In any case, the DSCAM, we have a DSCAM1, actually it's the one that you study in the in the lab is not, it undergoes some alternative splicing, but really few. So if you remember the browser screen, there is some alternative formats, not many of those. So completely different from the insects. Anyway, so this is the calcitonin CGRP, okay? And another story about alternative splicing that is important to remember is that we have an average, I mean, not all the exon can be alternative. This has to be clear to you. Whenever you have a human gene or mouse gene over there, you have average, there is 9 exons on average, maybe much more or much less, but anyway. And on this average, you have 1 or 2 alternative exons, no more than that. Okay, so we call constitutive the exons that are always present in the transcript. But if you remember a browser image, you probably remember that. Okay, and alternative exons, the ones that are either included or excluded, and you can find in the papers also this other definition, weak exon for alternative one. Okay. And of course, constitutive exon are called strong exon. And then the last thing about alternative splicing that I should remember with you is this one, that we have many schemes, possible schemes of alternative splicing. Okay, the most common is this one that is called exon skipping. That means you have an exon that can be either included or excluded. Okay, this is the most common scheme. It's most common also from an evolutionary point of view, but because, as you know, there is a theory, evolutionary theory, that says that exons are duplicated sequences of DNA that jumped in other genes in some way. So they recombine it with other genes. Now, an exon that jumps in another gene either go to another exon and probably destroys the gene, or goes to the introns, and in that case it is displaced there and probably is not in the right sequence to be spliced. So probably the sequence that is around the intron doesn't say this is a real exon, so they become probably alternative exons. Okay, so there is only an enormous theory about this. Anyway, we know that most of the alternative splicing events are this kind, exon skipping. Then we have two kind of events that are a little more complicated, that are the alternative 5 prime or alternative 8 prime. This means that you have two sites where there is a possible splicing and that they are played alternatively. This is donor side, this is acceptor side, and they are frequency like this. Okay. This is an older, as you can see, this is an older review than the paper we are considering. So the numbers will change a little bit in a minute as you see. Then we have phenomenon that are called intron retention. That means that the intron that is usually spliced out as a normal intron, but in some cases it is retained as a part of the exon. Okay. These events are quite rare, as you can see, 3%, and usually are linked to a phenomenon of getting the RNA out of frame. So if the intron usually is not exactly a multiple of 3, and also it is not is not evolutionary pressure to have a continuous sequence. So what you find is normally you find a stop codon here. So usually it's a truncated protein, it's eliminated. Okay. And then you have the last story, that is this mutually exclusive, as in the Drosophila diescam that you saw, and this is very rare, actually. Very rare, probably because it needs a kind of very special regulation. So probably this is the reason why. Anyway, now we can go back to the result that I showed you before. That is these numbers that you see here. So results of this paper. And then you see in the result of this paper that this is the number of skipped retained interim, alternative 5 prime, alternative 3 prime, exactly the same stories as before, and then mutually exclusive. Okay? So this is the total event they detected, the 1,000, of course. Okay, as you see. Retained interim, as you see, is very rare. Mutually exclusive is quite rare. Okay? And then you find 15 and 17 as a 5 prime and 3 prime alternative splicing, and again, skipped exon is the most common form of splicing. Okay? Then, they, as I told you before, they made this kind of sequencing in 15 different cell types. Okay? So the sequences was made in different cell types. So one of the conclusions that you can get from this sequencing is to see whether the splicing forms that have been detected were common to all tissues or specific for certain tissues. So as you can see here, they counted the number of tissue regulators, that means that are only in certain cells and not in other ones. And as you can see, this is the percent of tissue regulated. Okay? And as you can see, many events, this, they are actually tissue specific. And this is a general rule. Okay? Many splicing events are tissue specific. Okay? So they mean that in one tissue, the splicing apparatus drives to make one isoform, and in other tissues, it makes another arc. Exactly as this calcitonin in CGRP that we saw before, as a matter of fact. It's the first discovered, okay? You see also this tissue estimated. This is just because they follow it. You remember the curves that I showed you before? So they evaluated if I make all the sequencing depth possible, at which point you arrive. So this is the estimation if you have really deep sequence. Okay. Let's see the very first stories here are alternative first, alternative last, and tandem UTRs. This is something that, again, came up from this kind of sequencing because, of course, was very deep and very accurate. And this is alternative first exon. This was exactly what we saw here. This, we reflected, we discussed already this story. If I have this kind of splicing, I have a promoter here. So this is alternative first exon. Do you agree with me? Okay. So how many number of these alternative first they detected? They detected something like 14. And again, many, half of those are tissue-specific events, okay? And the same story is about the last exon, okay? So you can have the same situation in the very last story. So you can go to one exon that contains a stop codon there and a poly A signal, or to go to another exon farther away, which contains another poly A signal, okay? So this is exactly what you see here, okay? And you have something like 9 out of the total of 150 events of this kind. So a number not enormous, but you have something. And this tandem UTRs is a little different from here, because here you have real two alternative exons, this and this, that are spliced either this one or the other one. So this is a true splicing event, okay? On the other side, you may have a situation in which you have two different UTRs just because there are two alternative polyadenylation signals. So no differential splicing in this case, but just the machine for making poly-A, in one case decide to put the poly-A here, in the other case, decide to put the poly A here. So you have a different length UTR. And this is 7,000 cases out of 100 cases. What is the possible meaning of these UTRs, in your opinion? I mean, when you have this kind of events, of course, this will change the sequence of the protein, blah, blah, okay. And then we are in the 3' nuclear. So what can be the reason why the evolution made this kind of possibilities?
Different stability,
okay. So in this case, you have messenger RNA that ends with different sequences, and they can be completely different as stability, target of microRNAs, so they can change a lot in different situations. Okay, then what do we know about alternative splicing? And so we have to examine the ENCODE paper, so we probably can stop a few minutes to have a rest, then we start the results from this transcription analysis of ENCODE. Are you back? Most of you. Yeah. Okay. So this is the famous 30 papers introduction of the ENCODE in 2012. Just to remember you that you can visit the various stories to know what happens and this is one of the 30. So is the paper taking care of the landscape of transcription in human cells, and this high number of authors just reflect the fact that, of course, this study was done in different laboratories. It took an enormous amount of people to carry it out, because several cell lines, an enormous number of preparation of RNAs and sequencing and bioinformatic analysis. Many of those are actually bioinformatics, like this guy here, Roderick Guigot, who is and Thomas Gingras, that they are in Barcelona, the Center for Regulación Genómica. They are very important people. Anyway, so what they did was to take a number of cells, okay, and sequence with a very careful kind of preparation of RNA you will see in a minute. So they use the same 15 cells that you saw before in the other paper of 2008, that was actually chosen from the ENCODE committee several years before, as you can imagine. Okay, and what they did was to make an identification and characterization of annotated and novel RNAs. So this, I make a underline here, novel RNAs, that are enriched in either of the two major cellular compartments. Again, I make a line here because we didn't discuss the story, nucleus versus cytosol. Until now, we have only taken the RNA from the whole cell, so we cannot distinguish which RNA is in the cytoplasm and which RNA is in the nuclei. And of course, it makes an enormous difference, as you will see in a minute. In addition, they have sought to determine whether identified transcripts are modified their 5' and 3' termini by the presence of cap or polyadenylation. So they try also to distinguish which RNA is capped, which is not capped, which is polyadenylated, which is not polyadenylated. Okay? So these results considerably extend the current genome-wide annotated catalog with long polyadenylated small RNAs collected by the gene code annotation group. So gene code, actually, I don't know if you visited already as a browser. This, the database is the Gemini database of ENCODE project, anyway. So all results of ENCODE are reflected in gene code. Okay. So this is the more or less the summary of results that they obtained. Actually, they obtained much, much more than these few lines. That they are the summary. And we'll discuss all of them in a little bit depth after that. Okay. So the results, the main results are that first they found transcripts, so RNA, that represented something like 62% of the genome when they considered processed transcript. Processed transcript, what does it mean? Means that whenever you have RNA sequencing, okay, so you have a scheme of RNA, and you could align completely to the genome, this is unprocessed transcript, okay? Whenever your RNA is a little shorter, or variation, or whatever, or has a poly A, for example, something that cannot align to the genome, this is processed, okay? So if you use only processed transcript, you can cover, so in other words, this RNA that they saw, they refer to 62% of the genome. If you take unprocessed transcripts also, so the ones that you probably found in the nuclei, I make you thinking that usually the process of RNA takes place in the nuclei, so they go to the cytoplasm, usually they are processed. Okay? So if you think about unprocessed transcripts, you cover something like 75% of the genome. This was completely unexpected at the time, okay? So because we thought that actually only a small part of the genome was actually represented in RNA. So this is a kind of saying that actually our genome is pervasively transcribed, okay? Novel elements, so all the RNAs that they discovered, so they were undescribed before, they cover 78% of intronic nucleotides. So they were mostly intronic, in other words, okay? And 34% of intergenic sequences, okay? So they were outside described genes. The third information that they could get is that multiple isoforms per gene are expressed simultaneously with a plateau of something like 10 to 12 isoforms per gene per cell line. So enormous number of different isoforms coming out of single genes per cell line. And this, again, was completely unexpected. Okay, then they described eRNA. We discussed it already about eRNA. You remember the transcript started from enhancers. Okay. And then finally, 6% of coding and non-coding overlap with small RNA. Small RNA, essentially microRNA, as you know. One question is that this is very high as a content of transcribed sequences, that the question can be, is this feature conclusive? Conclusive means, okay, we know everything, go to sleep, and that's it, okay? This is not true, of course, because this is 15 cell lines. And you have always to consider that the expression, transcription, is cell type specific. So this means that probably if you continue sequencing different cell lines or different developmental stages, you will increase this figure. Okay, so they estimated that probably you can go up to this figure and reach something even higher than that. Okay, so they did, as I told you, they did subcellular compartment fractionation. So this is completely novel. They separate nuclei from cytoplasm and characterize the expression in the two compartments. All right. So they had data on whole cell, nucleus alone, and cytosol alone. Okay. And this is the novelty. In one line, that is this K562 cell line, they also performed additional nuclear subfractionation. It's a kind of tricky story. They subfractionate nuclei into chromatin, nucleoplasm, and nucleoli. And this we will probably consider on Wednesday, not today. It's very important to understand where the splicing is made. We will discuss it on Wednesday. So the RNA from each of these construct compartments were prepared in replica, so they have replica data, and were separated based on the length into more than 200 nucleotides and less than 200 nucleotides. So for each fraction, they sub-fractionated in short RNA and long RNA, and they were not content, satisfied about this, and they also, long RNA were further fractionated in polyadenylated and non-polyadenylated transcript. So all the fractions were subdivided in poly A plus, poly A minus. So as you can see, it's a kind of very careful and thorough study about this thing. Okay? Then they always sequenced by RNA-seq using the Illumina machine. And actually, they also complemented this RNA-seq by a number of other technologies. For example, they ran initiation of transcription analysis by CAGE, if you remember. And they also used 5' and 3' transcript termini description using this technology that is called PET, this paired N-tax. Okay, this paired N-tax is a method for full-length mRNA analysis. Actually, it captures and sequences the 5' and the 3' N-tax of full-length cDNA fragments. Okay. Sorry, I repeated it. Cut and paste. Anyway. Okay, so this is the story. This is the scheme of preparation that they used. You see here, whole cell, cytoplasm and nuclear. This is the subfraction only for one, if you remember, one line. Okay. Then both fractions were subfractionated by length. And again, the longer fraction, you know that the smaller RNA never have a poly A, so it's useless to make a fraction here. Poly A plus and poly A minus, same in this side, and then RNA-seq, RNA PET, and CAGE. So as you can see, it's an enormous story of analysis, okay? This is this is the same thing. Okay, so they discovered the number of novel RNA, of course, that cover 78% of the intronic nucleotides and 34% of the intergenic sequences. Okay, they say that the unique contribution of each cell line to the coverage of the genome tends to be small and similar for each cell line. So what it means is that you have specific transcript in different cell lines. Okay, so it's a kind of story. Finally, okay, they used an algorithm that you probably will study in bioinformatics, the CoFLIX, a famous one. And they could predict overall, so in general, long RNA-seq samples, 9,400 exons, 52 splice junctions, 73,000 transcripts, and 41,000 genes in intergenic and antisense region. So something that was completely undescribed. Okay, these novel elements increased the knowledge that was already in the gene code database by these numbers. Okay, so they have increased a lot the knowledge about transcription. So this is the resume of the story. And you see that you have cell, nucleus, cytosol, and this is cumulative in the sense that it's the sum of everything. And this is the fraction of RNA that they found. And this is poly A minus, poly A plus, and cumulative. Okay, so for example, as you can see, the poly A minus fraction is underrepresented in cytosol as compared to the nucleus. And this is completely expected, because if you remember, the poly A plus fraction is the actually messenger RNA that goes to the cytoplasm. Okay. Okay, I don't want to go through this slide that is quite cool, but just to tell you how many different kind of experiments and knowledge they could get out of it. Okay. Now, a large number of novel transcripts were classified as long non-coding RNA. The bulk, I mean the major part, most of the RNA they described as novel transcripts were actually long non-coding. And one question is how you can classify a non-coding RNA as non-coding. Well, of course, the first story is to look for the open reading frame. Okay? So whenever you have described the RNA, you look for, is there any ATG start codon in frame with a stop codon of sufficient length? This is a concept that I don't know if you have in your mind. Do you know what is the limit that usually people accept to have an ORF as a length? Usually we consider 300 nucleotides. It's a limitation because 300 nucleotides makes a protein of 100 amino acids. That is in the lower range of the proteins, known protein. So we don't know, maybe they are something less. For making link LNC RNA search, actually bioinformatics uses less. So they were down to the 60 nucleotides. Okay. How is this kind of frame considered? I mean, do you have clear what is an ORF? The books usually say that the ORF is a ATG in frame with a stop. But is that really true? I mean, can you evaluate in your mind how many occasions to have a stop codon can exist in a random sequence? ATG is fixed, so we can start the coding sequence only by ATG, okay? But then you have three stop codons. Can you evaluate the frequency of a stop codon in a random sequence? You remember how to evaluate the frequency of a sequence? What is the frequency of one nucleotide? 1 out of 4, okay? If you have a denucleotide, what is the frequency?
8.
No, 4 by 4. 1 out of 16. Can you follow me? Because the second is completely free from the one, the first, okay? So you have 4 times 4, 16. 3 makes 16 by 4, so 64. So means that one codon is found random every 64 bases. Okay? Good. Now we have 3 stop codons. So the frequency of a stop codon in a random sequence is 1 each more or less 20 bases. It makes a lot. So actually, the definition of an ORF is a little slightly different from what we learn from the textbook. It's not an in-phase sequence. It's a sequence that lacks any stop codon in frame. It's a little slightly different. Okay. So anyway, they look at for searching for this kind of criteria that is the first possible criteria as a RNA. And the second story is that when they look at for short ORFs, like 60 nucleotides or something, they look at for codon usage. I told you already that the human, for example, they use to have codons in the different possibilities. They only use one or two. So they look at for evaluating if the codon usage was correct or not. Third, they made interrogation of proteomic database, because of course if you have an ORF, you will have a peptide corresponding to that sequence. So looking at the database, they look at for possible peptides. Okay, and finally, they look at for association with ribosome, because if a peptide is, if a RNA is translated, you will find it in association with the ribosome. Can you follow me? Ribosomal preparation is not that difficult. You just make an extraction of the cytoplasm and then you run it through a gradient by centrifugation. So you can isolate mono ribosomes, D ribosomes and polysomes and whatever. And then you just purify the fraction and interrogate by PCR the sequence of your supposed link RNA. If you find it in association with ribosome, you make some guess about it, okay? So they used all these kind of criteria to purify the sequences that they found as a long non-coding RNA. So the ones that are classified now as a long non-coding RNA in the database are real non-coding, okay? With a very good confidence. Another important, extremely important story that I have to talk to you that is also concerning the review that you have as a textbook here is the transcript level. So how much we find in the samples, okay? So the transcript range in a sixth order of magnitude in Poirier. That is enormous, means that you have a 1 or 1 million as a dynamic range, okay? It's enormous. So they are RNA that are extremely low expressed and RNA that are hugely expressed, okay? And one of the story is that you have, for poly-A minus is a little, the range is a little narrow, okay? Anyway, there is a calculation, because some guy here, Mondazzavi et al., in a publication in 2008, they tried to calculate when you have RPKM, what does it mean in terms of molecule per cell? And this is not really so difficult calculation, because you more or less you know how many cells you take for making RNA preparation. Then you can spike in a different RNA to make a control and then make RNA-seq. So you can evaluate more or less how many molecules were at the beginning of the story. Okay. So they evaluated that 1 to 4 RPKM in an experiment of sequencing approximates to one copy per cell. Okay, so this is the estimation that they made. So the problem is that 1/4 of protein coding RNAs in this experiment of ENCODE and 80%, so means that 4 out of 5 of long non-coding RNA are expressed at less than one molecule per cell. Much less than one molecule per cell. Okay, there are this kind here, when you say 10 to the minus 2 RPKM means that you are much, much, much lower than one molecule per cell. Okay, so this raises a lot of problems, because what does it mean that I have less than one molecule per cell? The only possible explanation that is thoroughly discussed in your review is that you have some cell expressing a link, LNC RNA, and other cells that do not express it at all. Okay, so you have cell-specific expression of some of those. Okay, so let's see this complicated graph. This is the most difficult graphics that we have today, so just concentrate for a few minutes, I explain it, and the rest is much easier. This is a kind of picturing everything, okay? So as you remember, they made nuclear and cytoplasmatic analysis, okay? So for each single RNA transcript, they could evaluate how much was in the nucleus, how much was in the cytoplasm, okay? If you make logarithms of the ratio, and you plot over there, okay? So whenever you have a positive value, means that the amount of that particular RNA was higher in the nucleus than in the cytoplasm, okay? And vice versa, okay? And then in this x-axis here, they plotted the absolute amount of RNA, okay? Are you okay? More or less. Let's take one example. We can probably see if we have an example. For example, this is a protein coding gene. This red or something. These are the different cell lines analyzed, okay? And this is the location. So what it means is that, look only to these three cell lines here. This means that if you find a dot over there, means that you have quite high expression of those genes, because you have a logarithm 2 in this scale that is the absolute value, okay? And since the dots are in the lower part, so lower than 0, means that most of them reside in the cytoplasm, okay? In this FG2, for example, apparently you have a little lower transcript level, a little lower than the other one, but apparently it stays in the nucleus. So this probably means that the efficiency to which this gene, this mRNA, is transported to the cytoplasm is quite low in this cell line. Okay. Now, take another story here. You see, for example, this and this, they are very low expressed. Okay. So this is the absolute level of expression, and this is the ratio nucleocytoplasmatic. Okay. Now, what are these kind of? This is very similar to what you see in the meteo. Okay, exactly the same story. It means that when you have, you have to see it like a mountain. Okay, so when you have the summit in the mountain, it means that there are high frequency of genes that behave like this. Okay, and when you have lowest line, it means that you have lowest number of it. Okay? So you try to turn it and you see mountains. Okay, so this is the story. Now, look at the three different graphs that you see there. These are the brown here are protein coding. So all the transcripts that have a ORF, known or new, anyway, have a ORF. And as you can see, they are mostly in the highest part of as a quantity, absolute quantity, and they are, most of them, they are in the cytoplasmatic tract. That is normal. They are protein coding. They should go to the cytoplasm to be translated, okay? So everything fits. Now, these guys here, the blue one, are non-coding RNA, okay? Known means that they were previously described before encode, okay? In between them, you find, for example, the H19, that you may remember when we were looking at the imprinting regions. In the IGF-2 imprinting region, there was a non-coding RNA that was called H19. Then, of course, you will find in between those, you will find all the something exist, HOTER, all these guys that were known already before encode sequencing. Okay, and as you can see there, it changes the position. I mean, the amount is a little less because the mountain is in this left part of the graph, and then it's almost centered, so the distribution seems like half in the cytoplasm, half in the nuclei. Okay. Then look at the third. The third, that is the green one, is novel intergenic. That means these are the RNA that ENCODE discovered. And they discovered it because they, as you have seen in the procedure, they have made an enormous depth in the sequencing, separating all these kind of fractions. So they went extremely deep as compared to the other previous experiments. And they saw a number of RNA that, not surprisingly, are very low expressed. You see, the mountain is very far from the protein coding gene there. Okay? And also, consider another story. They are mainly nuclear. Mainly nuclear RNA, very low expressed. Do you know any RNA that probably fits with this category? ERNA, for example, that they are extremely unstable, so they go there. And then another one that we studied last lesson. You remember RNA A, the one that was interacting with the mediator? Do you? It was one of the last slides, not the real last lesson, but the one before, in which I described the RNA that comes from maybe an answer close to a gene, and was interacting with the mediator component. This actually is connecting the mediator there. So that means that probably it's transcribed one molecule per cell and stay there for a while. So this probably will be in the very low amount on the left, and this nuclear. So probably we have many instances in which we have this situation there. And the reason why they are novel is just because they are too scarce to be detected before. Okay, so with the previous technologies and the previous experiments the people made, it was impossible to detect this kind of guys there. Okay, so your reviews discussed about the reality of these transcripts. Because, of course, when the ENCODE results were presented, were published, there was a quite important discussion about, is this transcriptional noise? What is transcriptional noise? You can imagine that the RNA polymerase is there. There are many genes, and sometimes it makes a transcript like by chance, especially when you have this lowest part. Okay, so in other words, are they functional? Or just a kind of side product of the activity? And so in the review, they discuss a lot about this story. It was, okay, so the other important story that we've seen from ENCODE was the alternative isoform. Not only alternative splicing, but also the isoform coming from different transcription start site or ending differently. And as you can see here, if you look at the number of annotated isoforms per gene, annotated isoform means that in the database there are different isoforms. And here you look for the number of isoforms that are expressed per gene, you see that there is an increasing number that plateaus more or less here. So they conclude that we have something like 10 to 12 maximum isoform per gene here. Okay, this is the diagonal, just to see that you have a curve like this that makes a plateau over there. Okay, and also another story that is important is that whenever you have many different transcripts, as you saw in the gene browser, there is only one that is prevalent. You never see a situation in which you have two transcripts that are equally represented. Okay? There is only one, there is always one that is prevalent on the other ones. And you see here very clearly. This is the number of annotated isoforms, starting from one here. Of course, when you have only one isoform, this is the maximum expression. When you have two isoforms, you see that you have one that is more expressed than the other one, so the distribution is like this. That means that one is 80% and the other one is 20%. Okay, and then you see that this is decreasing. Okay, so whenever you go to many isophores, you always have one that is more expressed and the other one that are less expressed. Okay. So this is also the reason why the encode places. You have gone to the encode, to the ensemble. Have you used the browser ensemble? They have numbers. So they always place one as the principal one. Okay. Usually the most expensive. Okay. So these are the numbers again. A total of 128,000 TSS. So as you can imagine, if you make the ratio to the genes, you see that many of the genes have different TSS. Of those, almost 100 were previously annotated and the other were novel. Okay. Making cage tags, they identify a total of 82,000 non-redundant TSS. And there is a difference, of course. We discussed it already. When you make RNA-seq, you never go exactly to the first nucleotide, because RNA-seq makes random fragments. So the ones that are closest to the beginning, they are too short to be sequenced, so you fall down. Okay? And if you compare with a cage tag, the cage really maps the initial nucleotide, you see that almost all the cage identified TSS are located within 500 base pairs of the RNA-seq detected. So it means that when you approach as close as that 500, you actually probably lose the frequency of detecting the correct TSS. Okay. ERNA, they of course detected the RNAs, and this is plus tracks and this is minus tracks. So around all the presumptive enhancers were identified by ChIP-seq data, of course, in parallel. And as you can see, many of those, the highest fraction of those is poly-I mannose. So the ERNA usually are not poly-I related. Not all of them. Actually, if you look at the poly-A sequence, you also have a signal. So it means that sometimes this ERNA gets derivated, of course, but nobody knows. Okay. So what I have to tell you is that, going just to the textbook of Davison that I gave to you. As you have seen from the ENCODE results, linker average expressed a very low range. So now people have developed technical tricks to increase the amount of sequences that you can have from link. And especially they use targeted RNA-seq. That means that you use primers that are already targeting specific LNC RNAs, so you can amplify them much more than the other sequences. And the other comment that I want to make is that there are today many different databases reporting long non-coding RNAs. And due to the fact that they are low expressed, don't be surprised that these databases are so different from each other. So if you look at the GeneCode, you find something like 15,000 RNA mapped. If you go to the MiTranscriptome, for example, that is a USA-based database, they have something like 58,000, so something like three times more. Okay. This only depends on the kind of sequencing that is made and the acceptance rate. You have to discuss with the bioinformatic guys, the prof, sorry. So whenever you look at the long non-coding RNA, you have that only 1% of genes has a high expression. All others are, as you can see, as the graph falls down rapidly, most of the genes, they are very low expressive. Okay? So the problem is that, again, repeating the fact that when you make RNA sequencing, you sample the RNAs. You don't sequence all of them, you just make a sample of them. This means that when you have a relatively high expression, you have a linear range. That means that the measured abundance is linear to the expected abundance, more or less that linear. But when you are in a very few events, so imagine to have a long non-coding RNA that is expressed as we saw before, like two molecules overall. Of course, the number of reads that you can detect is completely stochastic. So in one experiment, you can detect zero. In another one, you detect two. And you have to decide if this part of RNA is true or not. So some of the database decide yes, or the database decide no. And this makes the difference in between the amount of RNA that is described in different databases. Okay? The expression of long non-coding RNAs apparently is highly tissue-specific, extremely highly specific, so as compared to protein-coding genes. For example, we are studying in the lab one long non-coding RNA that came out from breast cancer, and is incredible because it is specific to cancer. No normal sample ever showed the expression of this guy. It's specific to breast cancer. You compare with any other kind of tumors, no expression, especially only in breast cancer. And when you look at subtypes of breast cancer, because there are at least 3-4 subtypes of breast cancer, depending on the genetic alteration that drives the tumor, is specific only to one of the subtypes. And this is spectacular because you don't find any protein coding gene that has such a spectacular specificity to one type of cells. Okay? So they are, at this moment, they are extremely interesting for that story. There are other data that will probably interest our neurobiologists in the classroom. That is, of course, many of these long non-coding RNAs have been studied by fish analysis in preparation of brain. Okay, and this is another spectacular story. So many of these, if not all, of these long non-coding RNA are limited to one cell type. So you look this fish analysis and you see just few cells in a region express the story. So this probably also justifies the fact that when you take the complete tissue, you have so low amount of RNA, okay? Because it's diluted out of everything. But if you can take single cells, probably you have very high expression also of this RNAs. And this is what we are starting to see with the novel technology that is single-cell RNA-seq. Technology appeared only very recently in our field. I don't tell you about it. Professor Kutrupi will tell you about this single-cell analysis. And this is extremely important and interesting because there are few studies published today that show very clearly that when you take cells from a tissue, sometimes you have expression of long non-coding RNAs only in 1-2 cells. So you have extremely heterogeneous expression patterns. And this probably is linked to the fact that you have differentiation of different subtypes that histology cannot appreciate. But these cells are not stochastic. They are really expressing different genes to make different, probably different phenotypes in a tissue. This is very, very important. Okay. I finished this. All this you find in the textbook, so I don't need to spend much time to this. Just to tell you that whenever you have either a protein coding gene or a non-coding genes or whatever, you make RNA-seq You never can decide which is the single isochrone, okay? You have a signal like this one, okay? And you decide that there is a splicing like this, but you cannot decide that this splicing is accompanied, for example, by a shorter TSS, because you just see the signals. You cannot associate one event with the other, okay? And this is particularly true when you look at the non-coding RNA that are less abundant, okay? So you may have this kind of situation that you never pick up, like this one, okay? So today we have the possibility of making single molecule view. That means to sequence single molecules of RNA. So you can distinguish if a certain exon accompanies the other, or one, or the transcription start side, or whatever, okay? And this is done, okay, you can find, there are fundamentally two technologies available today. I don't know if you talked about it in bioinformatics, did you? Yeah. You can, okay, there are very short videos, like 3 minutes. Okay, each. So we don't have time to show it today, but you can please take a look at it. Because this is the Oxford Nanopore is based on a channel derived from aquaporin. Do you know what is aquaporin? Okay, they make the recombinant proteins in order to make the DNA going through, single DNA going through, and the conductance is measured on the surface. So each nucleotide makes a little different perturbation of the conductance, and you can have the sequence. So in that case, you can sequence all the RNA in the same full length. This is very interesting for that. And the other technology is Pacific Bio, that you can also have a look to this. And this is based on zero wavelength analysis. It's a little more complicated story. But instead of having a molecule and a polymerase that makes it sequence, they fix the polymerase on a surface and make the and made the RNA going through the polymerase. And you register the signal, fluorescent signal over there. So with these technologies that today are really expensive for the moment, this is very expensive. It's quite precise. Nanopore is not expensive at all, but the problem is that it makes a lot of errors to date. So it's used, but not that much. We may probably improve the definition of the splicing force or whatever. Okay, I think that we can stop here because I have other slides, but actually they are just things that you can find in the reading. Okay, so not really complicated. Just, okay.